Well, thank you very much. You may notice that that title is quite different from what's in your book. It turned out that I apparently submitted basically a homeless abstract for this conference, and they didn't know where to put me. And at the about halfway, a couple months after I submitted, they said they found a spot for me, and I'm like, that's great. And then once I got online and saw what else was going on in this session, I figured what I was going to talk about didn't really fit that well with what's going on. So I decided to go with some of my other work. While it doesn't really go into no-till and pasture systems, it does deal with the nitrogen transformations within the poultry litter that many of you are applying in your systems. And if we're able to understand the mechanisms by which the nitrogen is transferred, you may be able to take advantage of that to reduce some of these losses when you're going to apply them and with your different technologies. So basically, ammonia is a problem. That's not a surprise to anybody. In the house itself, ammonia levels as low as 10 parts per million can be harmful to bird health over shorter periods of time. And over longer periods of time, human workers can also be affected by these levels. Not only are there health issues with the ammonia, but there's also a variety of environmental quality issues of the surrounding area, including things such as soil acidification and water eutrophication. Question comes in, where does all this ammonia come from? Well, poultry litter and the excreta are a very large source of organic nitrogen, and that is basically an excellent pool for the microbes in the litter to mineralize to form ammonia. And 70% of that total nitrogen in the poultry litter is in the forms of uric acid and urea, two organic nitrogen sources very easily mineralized by microbial populations. So the central issue in this whole area is, how do we deal with the ammonia being produced? And to improve it and improve both environmental quality and the productivity and sustainability for the poultry industry. So now there's a couple different methods to attack this issue, and I've broken them into two main areas. One is to try to stop it before it's produced, and one is to accept that it's produced and treat it before it leaves the house via the air or via the litter. I'm going to talk today just about adding amendments to the litter to reduce or inhibit the volatilization. The talk in the actual program dealt with that bottom part there. So if anyone wants to talk to me about what that was all about, you can find me after this talk. So, acidification of poultry litter. It's one of the more widely used methods for controlling ammonia in the poultry industry. And the three main commercial dry acid amendments are AllClear, which is an alum, PLT, which is 93% sodium bisulfite, and PoultryGuard, which is an acidified clay. There have been many studies looking at the physicochemical responses of the litter to these dry amendment applications, and also on the effects of the soil once the litter is applied. But there's very little information out there on the effects on the microbial populations. So that is pretty much what I see as a major knowledge gap in this existing research. So how does this acidification affect interactions between the physicochemistry and microbiology of poultry litter? And ultimately, what does that have to do with the nitrogen dynamics in litter? So we set up a lab incubation experiment. So basically, we took a bunch of containers with poultry litter. We either added 10% weight per volume of one of those three acidifiers or left one without any acidifying amendment as a control. We increased the moisture, let it go for 4 months, and tested it either biweekly at the beginning and monthly as it got a little later. And we basically analyzed as much as we could out of these incubations to get as much data as possible. So you'll see that we did a bunch of physicochemical analyses. The ones I'll basically be speaking about today would be the organic nitrogen and the uric acid in urea. We did a variety of microbiological analysis, including sequence analysis and DGGE, which I won't go into, and real-time PCR, which is some of the data that I'm going to be showing. So if you'll just bear with me, I'm probably the lone microbiologist you'll be hearing from today, and hopefully you'll get some interest out of what I'm going to tell you. And lastly, we looked at some gas emissions, which I probably won't have time to get into. So, like I said, we know basically you add the acidifier to the litter and the end result is less ammonia. Well, what happens with the microbial populations? Because it's accepted that the microbes are responsible for this process, but there hasn't been really any look at what they're doing. So this is a real-time PCR. This is basically just tracking concentrations of, on the top, bacteria, and on the bottom, fungi over time during the incubation. The colored lines are the three different acidified treatments, and the black line is the control. So basically what we found was that acidification resulted in a 1 to 2 log reduction in bacteria within the first 2 months, generally for the acidified treatments. And in two of the treatments, those populations actually recovered by the end. Whereas for the fungus, when you acidify, you basically increased the fungal populations by 4 to 5 logs. So there's a humongous fungal bloom that occurs in these acidified litters, which is pretty much what I just said. And it's important to note that these shifts in dominance occurred within 1 month of acidification. So while these are laboratory incubations and not directly applicable to a house, it's good to remember that a typical grow-out period in a house is 42 to 56 days. So if we're going to see any kind of trends within the microbe population, we'd like to see it in the time span when it would actually occur within a house. So the whole idea of this study was to see how the microbes affect the organic nitrogen, or the nitrogen transformations in the litter. So what we have here is I have an indicator. It's called we made the 16S to 18S indicator. So that's basically comparing a ratio of the bacterial to fungal populations. So the higher that number is on the, on the right-hand side of these graphs means it's more bacterially dominated. When it gets below 1 to below 0, it's more fungally dominated. So in terms of the normal litter with nothing applied, you will find that a large amount of the organic nitrogen loss occurs within the first 2 weeks, and then there's a slow increase over time. And during this entire incubation, bacteria predominated the entire community. But when you look at these other three here, you'll see that in the black here is the relationship between the bacterial and fungus. It significantly starts to decrease in all three cases, meaning that you're having this fungal bloom and it's becoming to a level equaling that of the bacteria. And during that time period, if you look at the open circles, there's very little organic nitrogen loss occurring. So something's going on, the shift over in the microbial population that is, at that same time, no organic nitrogen loss is occurring. And once, and you can see on these two on the right here, once this stabilizes, this ratio begins to stabilize, you'll see that organic nitrogen loss begins to increase. So it looks like there's some kind of switch over it that delays the organic nitrogen mineralization, and once the populations become stable once again, then the organic nitrogen loss picks up. So that was interesting, but we were only looking at very broad groups at that point. So now we're going to have to go and look at more specific groups that are important in the actual mineralization process. And we're going to look at two different enzymes, the uricase enzyme here that starts the mineralization process, and the urease enzyme, which actually produces the reaction that produces the ammonia. So we wanted to try to specifically target those microbes. So to do that, I'll try to go through this kind of quick. We used a general urease primer, which looked at basically all urease present in the poultry litter. We got a lot of clones, so we sequenced those clones and found that nearly 90% of all my clones ended up in this group up here, which was unlike any other urease in the database. It was only the closest match was 71% to a Pseudomonas. But when you put it in the database, it recognizes it as a urease. So it's a urease, it just doesn't like anything else. So what I did is I went to these sequences, made my own primers to specifically target that group, and these are the primers and probes, and then I designed and optimized assays to just look at that group and the concentrations of that dominant group in the litter and not anything else. And I did that same process for a number of different organisms. I looked at two different uricases for the bacteria, and the reason we chose those is the only two papers in the literature we found that talked about the dominant bacterial uricases. It was those two genera, so we decided to target for those two. And then we looked for the two different enzymes in an aspergillus-like, And the reason we chose those is because previous research in our lab showed that Aspergillus is one of the dominant fungal types that occurred in that fungal bloom. So previous work showed, when you look at just those bacterial urease primers, so just the bacteria that are producing the ammonia, you see in the black here, those are the numbers in the non-treated litter. So they stay relatively stable for a month, and then they decrease down to zero. Whereas the fungus in the red here, they're never high. They're practically zero the whole time. And so when the bacterial number are highest, you'll see this huge increase in organic nitrogen hydrolyzation. And then it's basically stable after that as the bacteria begin to decrease. When you compare that to the acidified litter, you see the bacterial urease producers start to go down instantly and go down to zero by the end. When you look at the fungus in the red, you see a huge increase within the first month and is highly stable for the rest of the experiment. And the organic nitrogen here is slow, so our hypothesis is there's a turnover between bacteria to fungus that is delaying the organic nitrogen mineralization, but once there's a stable population, you see a huge increase. So that was just for organic nitrogen, and we want to go and look at specifically, rather than just organic nitrogen, we can go in and actually measure uric acid and compare it to the uricase enzymes and look at urea and compare that specifically to the urease enzymes. And what we found here was in the normal situation, it was almost practically all bacteria, you have a steady hydrolysis of uric acid over time. That's the green bar, which is kind of green. Whereas when you look at these two acidified treatments here, you see in red here is the increases in the fungal population, and you'll see in black you get decreases in the bacterial population. And again, you see this delay, the huge increase occurs once the fungal populations become stable. And PLT was kind of the redheaded stepchild from the whole experiment, and I won't go much more into that. And you'll see similar results here with the urea. In the normal, you have the urea content stays stable during the entire experiment when you've got practically no fungus. But in the two acidified treatments on the right here, you have huge increases in the fungal numbers that are shown in red. And when they increase and the bacterial decreasing, you see a net accumulation of urea. But once the fungal numbers become more stable and are slowly increasing, you see this urea here is actually mineralized at that point. So it looks like there's a switch over. As they become more dominant, they switch over and they begin to chew up and chew on the urea and produce the ammonia. So the conclusions, previous understanding, the pH decreased, you caused ammonia to decrease. And that was really what they were concerned about. They knew the microbes are important, but not really specifically what was going on. So our kind of new view is when you've got the pH decreases due to acidification, you decrease your bacterial numbers and you increase your fungal numbers. And within that first month, you increase or you don't lose much of your organic nitrogen, which will keep ammonia levels down. And this is what's happening in the specific populations of urea and uricase. But what happens is later in the grow-up period, once the fungal numbers here become stabilized and the bacteria start to come back, that's when organic nitrogen starts to be decreased and then ammonia levels start to go up. So while you have slowed down the production of ammonia, it just still occurs within 2 months. So after 2 months, there's very little difference between the acidified and the non-acidified treatments. So this is just the last slide. Where are we basically, what are we going to do from here? So like I said, that's delayed, but the problem is once the pH reaches 8, all the ammonium that's in either the acidified or the non-acidified litter will volatilize, which will reduce the fertilizer value. So the idea would be to try to keep organic nitrogen in the litter and while keeping ammonia levels down. So to do that, just some ideas, we want to try to maybe include a fungicide in the amendment strategy. So to use the acid to take care of the bacterial population, then use a fungicide to try to inhibit the fungal population, and therefore you won't see much of this organic nitrogen mineralization. And another idea, which we haven't got to, but would be interesting, competitive exclusion. We accept that the fungal population will increase, but we try to put in our own non-uricase and non-urease producing strains to take over, for the uricase and urease producing ones. So the fungal bloom will occur, but that organism will not be able to perform the nitrogen transformations. Thank you very much.